I remember coming up here and being with Angela's family and having our rehearsal dinner and everyone standing up and saying loving things about us. And we said loving things about them. It was like a four-hour sob fest. It really was. Anyone who was there remembers it. You can bring up the lights. That's great. Anyone who's there remembers it because we wanted to take time to not only, you know, eat together and give our wedding party gifts, but we also wanted to just share publicly what they meant to us. And then I guess the floor was opened, and they were able to get up and share things about us. And I remember the poor guy that was officiating the wedding. He was a pastor that was pretty new in the area, and he was just dying 1,000 deaths as this thing went hour after hour after hour after. I remember looking at him being like, you know, and in my mind, I'm like, what's wrong with this guy? And then after being in ministry now for a while, it's like, it's not quite the same to sit there and soak it in when you're sort of, you play a part in the event, but it's not like your group of people necessarily. So anyway, it was a great night. And I remember getting to the morning, I remember everyone went out to breakfast and I couldn't eat. I had the butterflies and just a lot of nerves. And I remember getting ready, and I remember my mom had asked that I would shave this beast off of my chin because she said, that's never going to stay. You're going to regret these pictures. In just a couple years, that'll be gone. So 14 years later, it's still there. But for two short weeks when I got married, it was gone. So that makes all my wedding pictures makes me look like I'm like 12 years old or something. But I remember getting ready and getting up to the church and sitting there and reading passages of Scripture, reading out of 1 Corinthians 13 and Proverbs 31. Thinking about what it was going to mean now to love someone this way. Thinking about a Proverbs 31 woman and definitely seeing many characteristics in Angela. When the moment arrived, I remember standing up front. Did we have eight on each side, babe, or seven? Something like that. It was an enormous, it like wrapped around the front of the church. It was just way too many, but we just were blessed with great friendships. And I remember standing up there with my guy friends as each of the girls was walking down the aisle, the bridesmaids. And it was just interesting because as they're coming down, I'm just thinking, I'm glad it's not you. No, I'm just kidding. I did not say that. I did not say that at all. That's only funny because of the four bridesmaids that were not family, I had dated three of them. So I did say that a few times. They probably were saying it about me on the way down, like, I'm so glad my dress is black and not white right now. But the moment came and she came around the corner. And we had protected that moment. I had not seen this dress. I had avoided her all morning, and she came around the corner, and I love that music changes, and everyone stands up, which obscures the view of the groom a little bit more and makes it a little more mysterious as you're trying to see, because this church, you kind of came in from the back corner and then came to the center aisle and then made your way, and I remember seeing her, and my mouth, my jaw just fell agape, just open. I was just struck with awe as I saw her with her father holding on to her with her arm in one hand and a gun in the other. No, he did not do that, thankfully. But as they came down the aisle every step, what was racing through my mind was, she's for me. Her eyes were fixed on me, just locked in. We locked eyes. And I remember every step she took, she was coming closer and closer, and my heart was racing with excitement and honestly with fear as well. It's a big moment. I felt very, very, very unworthy in that moment. Very much ill-prepared for what I was about to say in front of all of my friends and family. And she came closer and closer, and then her father handed her to me, gave her a kiss, and then handed her to me and went and sat down. In that moment, as she came down the aisle wearing her white dress, it's always the picture that I get in my mind of what it means to be loved fully, what it means to be radiant, what it means to be pure, a picture of holiness, a picture of security, of confidence. No guilt, no shame. Just walking in purity and in confidence and in beauty towards me. And as I waited for her, it's interesting, and I don't know if this is meant to be some sort of a precursor, but you know, I know for the guys, I was ready, and we were standing up here waiting, and we were just waiting for her to get there, waiting for her to finish getting ready and then to arrive where I was waiting. I don't know if that was meant to be a glimpse of spending time waiting in the car for her to get ready and then join me to where we're going. Just kidding. She's actually quite punctual. As I waited for her to arrive, thoughts were racing through my mind. Amazement that she chose me. But as we talked about last week, that ceremony, that moment where I stood in front of all of my friends and family and the guys that would have loved to have been standing in my spot, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't realize the depth of the commitment I was making. I didn't realize the cost. I focused on the exciting parts of the commitment and not necessarily the ones that were going to cost me something. It's very interesting because if you look at a wedding, it is absolutely the celebration of something huge and something new. So on one hand, it's a celebration of a new life being formed, right? Because we believe that when the husband and the wife, and we'll look at this in a minute in Ephesians 5, but that the husband and the wife become one flesh. It's really bad, confusing math. It's that one plus one equals one. Don't tell my daughters that formula because I really want them to have a good shot in math as they grow up. But in order for that to work, there has to be some other variable. There has to be something else that happens. There has to be something subtracted. And so I think in that sense, you have 1 plus 1 equals 1. You've got the life, the birth of this new thing, of this new person, this new identity. In fact, at the end of the ceremony, what does the pastor say? He says, it's my great honor and privilege to introduce to you for the very first time. Now, their friends and their family, and they've watched you grow up. They know who you are. What do you mean introduce to me for the very first time? They introduce to you Mr. and Mrs. Cliff Johnson. A new thing emerges. Her name is changed to reflect that we are now one. And so it's the celebration of life, but in a sense, it's also a death of sorts. Because in order for one plus one to equal one, there has to be the subtraction of one. And so this morning, I want to focus on what that looks like. What kind of love is it where there is a death, and the death is the dying to myself? It's a picture of what it means to die to oneself. Because of love. Dying. To become one. Sometimes we choose elements to illustrate this. Some choose unity, a unity candle. And I've officiated a few weddings in my day, and whenever you have open flame and hair products and perfumes of all sorts and lace and flowers, there tends to be some sort of dangerous element to this. And I think that's part of the excitement, is that we're going to try to light this thing over here and try not to. So one time, the wick of the candle, no one had really inspected it, and the wick was too low. So mid-wedding, they could not get this thing lit. I mean, you know, the harp or whatever's playing, and they're running out of time, and I'm like, let's go. And they're like, we can't do it. He's, you know, the groom's burning his fingers like raw because the pressure and everything. And somehow, miraculously, one of the groomsmen pulled out a hunting knife that was in his tuxedo. Like, who puts a hunting knife in their tuxedo just in case this happens? I was really nervous after that. My goodness, glad he's on our side. So they're up there literally carving out the wick and lighting it to get this thing to roll. Some choose unity sand, where you've got blue sand and you've got white sand. You mix them together into a central sand container of some sort and then say, you could never separate this. You could, it would just take a really long time and be very difficult. It's meant to mix them together. Another wedding I did, the husband, the groom, actually washed his bride's feet in a beautiful act of humility and submission and love. So we use a lot of symbols to picture this. This 1 + 1 = 1, but there has to be a -1 in there. There has to be a death to oneself. And this is explained in Ephesians chapter 5, if you want to turn with me there. We've got a few different passages we're going to kind of camp out in today. Ephesians 5. It actually is set up by verse 21, which in your Bible may be a part of a previous paragraph, but it really does start this final section. Verse 21 says, submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Now we're gonna focus on that in 2 weeks. So we're going to focus more on the guy's responsibility this morning. Verse 25, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is profound, and I'm saying that it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects his husband. I love that. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. So let's pause there. So as I've done some wedding ceremonies in my time, I've also done some premarital counseling with others. And sometimes we've walked through this passage or it's just marriage counseling after the wedding has taken place. And this passage becomes a sticking point where an angry husband may say, well, she's just not submitting to me. And the point of this passage is not who should always win or who should always be right. It's set up by saying submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. The idea of this is look at what the husband is being asked to do. If we look at it and we say, wow, well, the wife is being asked to submit, but the husband is just being asked to love her. That seems like an easier job. Read it very closely. What is the husband actually being asked to do for his wife? The husband must love his wife as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. How did Jesus die? How did Jesus give himself up for the church? But he died, right? He died for the church. He died for us. He literally set aside his rights. He set aside anything that he could have been owed. He set everything aside and sacrificed himself for us. He died. He died for us. Because Jesus Christ died for us, we can now die to ourselves. He died for, we get to die too. die, and when I say to, I mean T-O, not T-O-O, not also. But we get to die to our flesh. We get to die to sin. We get to die to blindness. We get to die to being lost. We get to die to all of those things. For I have died, and Jesus Christ now lives in me. We get to die to who we once were and take up who we are now in Jesus. It's a new identity. It's a new relationship. It's a new picture. So we look at this picture. We say, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. It's this idea that we as husbands are to be willing to die to ourselves. Die to ourselves. Be willing to set aside, give up, lay aside what may have been our right, what may have been our thing that we're into. It may have been something that we feel completely able to do or desirous of doing, or something that we're like, no, I don't ever want to have to give this up. To love your wife as Christ loved the church means being willing to die to that thing. And the idea of humility is very interesting because husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. The picture of what Jesus did was that he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on the cross. And so it's a picture of humility. It's a picture of mutual submission because the wives are definitely told to submit, but the husbands are also told to elevate their love. It's interesting because if you look at the historical context, in the city of Ephesus, this was a city with a very proud tradition of strong women. They believed that they had descended. They were kind of an Amazonian strength, strong women. In fact, you know, they were strong hunters. And in fact, they were so intense on how they would hunt and how they would defend and fight that some even removed a breast so that they could be better with the bow. They were in leadership positions. They were politically active. They had power. They had wealth. And they worshipped a god by the name of Artemis, which was a female god of fertility. Artemis in Ephesus was the number one industry. It was the biggest thing. They had the temple to Artemis in Ephesus, and it was enormous. It was one of the wonders of the world. Their banking system went through the temple. You know, their economy was deeply impacted by it. Each year they had something called the Artemisian Festival, where hundreds of thousands of people from around the world would come to worship Artemis in unspeakable ways. Part of this process, part of the way that these men would show their devotion to Artemis was to emasculate themselves and try to offer their masculinity to Artemis. And so when women are being told to submit, it's a picture of them humbling themselves and allowing men that have been pushed down to lead, forcing men to lead. And when men are told to love as Jesus Christ loved, it's telling men to elevate. It's telling them to come up, bring up the level of your devotion, bring up the level of your commitment, bring up the level of your leadership. And then the whole passage is covered by the statement that says, submit to each other mutually. So women are to come down in this passage. Men are to rise up. And the picture is to mutually submit to each other out of humility and reverence for Jesus Christ, who humbly submitted himself to the cross to save us because of love. That's the picture that we look at. That's the picture that informs this. That's the idea that Paul is trying to get across when he talks about the kind of love that is expected here. Love your wife as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. When Jesus died, he placed an intrinsic value on each human being. We already had worth and value because man is created in the image of God, but Jesus ramped that up by once and for all saying that you are worth dying for. You are worth dying for. And I think when we get married as husbands, we're saying, you know what, I would die for her. I would die for my wife. I would lay down my life for her. And in our minds, we imagine this scene out of a movie or whatever where someone may be coming towards her and we jump in front like a Secret Service agent and take the bullet and die physically in some blazing, glorious moment that we will be forever memorialized for. And there's nothing wrong with thinking that way, but that's not where it ends. That's a lot like someone who says, I just wanna go somewhere where it's dangerous and I wanna die for Jesus. But yet that same person struggles to live for him. To tell your wife or husband that they are worth dying for doesn't just mean the willingness to step in harm's way physically to protect them. It means that you are willing to die for them daily. Die to your preferences. Die to your rights. Die to your selfishness. Die to what you think you deserve. Anybody can die for someone or say that they will when the bullets are flying. The question is, are we willing to die for each other daily? The Bible gives a word for, uses a special word to describe this kind of love. We've talked about this over the last several weeks, and even before that, there are different Greek words for love. There's a Greek word that means a love that's kind of a preference, like I love Mama Gina's calzones, or I love the Yankees. You know, it's like you aren't willing to die for them, and I could say that now. You know, there maybe was a season where if someone offended my Yankees, I would have gotten violent, but I'm good now. They can defend themselves. So it's just that word for that is storge. It's just sort of a like, a strong affection. And then there's eros, which is sort of the raw physical attraction, lust. You know, just like you see something and you're like, wow, that's amazing. It's just that magnetism. It's eros. Then you've got phileo, which is that brotherly love, that friendship, that great level of strong affection, family bond. And then there's a word for love that's the highest form of love. It's sacrificial love. It is a love that says, I am willing to die. And that's agape love, agape love. Agape love. Now, agape love is quickly defined as unconditional. And I've said before, publicly and privately, that this is something that's very hard for me to say that I'm able to do, to love without condition. Because conditions change things. That's the nature of unconditional. It's saying when conditions change, when feelings change, when an event happens, when someone wrongs you, when something bad occurs, how will you respond? Because love is not merely a feeling. Love is not merely a warmth in your heart or a warm fuzzy and be like, man, I just love them. When I think of them, it makes me smile. That's true to an extent, but true love is demonstrated. True love is action. True love is when the chips are down, you love still. So the unconditional love means that no matter what happens, we keep on loving. And the unconditional love of Jesus for us is a picture of this that we can point to. It's saying, no matter what happens, no matter what you've ever done before, no matter what you're doing now, what you ever will do again, Jesus' love for us is such that we cannot be separated from it. It will never change. It will never fade away. It is unconditional. So at this wedding ceremony, when I'm standing across from my bride, I am pledging my love to her, and the love that I am pledging to her, if we were to be speaking in classical Greek or in Koine Greek at that moment, I would not say, I promise you my brotherly love. I promise you my strong like. I storge you. She'd be like, what are you doing? It'd be like now, like someone being like, I love you. And you'd be like, I really, really like you. It's just not the same. What do you mean you like me? What is that supposed to mean? I just said I love you. And you came back with you really, really like me? Did the second really, was that supposed to sell it to me? That it's better than normal like a Facebook like of a picture of a cat. It's a really, really like. It's like a super thumbs up or something. I don't know what that is. You'd never say that. The wedding would be over immediately if you edited the content of the vows on the fly. I'm not sure I can really love like that. Can you just back it down to a strong like for me, Pastor? That's not going to, she's going to be like, okay, we need to talk for a quick minute away from the microphones. What are you doing? No, so we're standing in front of all of our friends and family, and we're saying, I love you. Agape love, the highest love I'm capable of, unconditional love, a love that surrenders, a love that gives, a love that says I'm willing to die for you. And we offer that up. It's amazing because when you look at love, I think sometimes I love based on an expectation that change is going to occur. Not I love you for who you are right now if you never ever change, but a love that says I love you, but I'll really love you as you change and become more like the person I want you to be. That's not agape love. That's conditional. That's like potential love. Agape says, I love you for who you are right now. If nothing changed, if nothing was different, if you never ever became the man or woman I want you to be, I love you right now. That's a decision you need to make that I'll tell people that are getting married. If they never change, if they never become the guy you wish they would be, are you okay with that? Because that's unconditional love. Don't put a condition. Don't put an asterisk on and say, I really hope he changes, but I'm going to go ahead and marry him and let's see this thing play out. That's a bad plan. That's a really bad plan. And it's not unconditional love. Unconditional love is the idea that you love someone as if they are already who you want them to be. It's loving someone into their future. It's treating that husband of yours or that wife of yours, loving them as if they are everything you've ever dreamed them to be, loving them so strong, loving them so well, saying, you know what, you are the greatest thing about me. You are someone I love completely and fully. And even as they make mistakes, even as they mess up and disappoint you, say, I'm choosing to believe in you. I'm choosing to love you no matter what other indicators are saying, I am loving you. I'm loving the best version of you. I'm believing that this is who you are, and I'm loving you that way. And I'm not allowing these other conditions to change that. If you look at Jesus and how he led and how he loved his disciples, it's amazing. He chose the lowest of the low and then treated them and loved them as if they were already who he wanted them to be. And then at some point, something clicks, and we start to believe it. Because how we understand who we are, our understanding of the love that we receive dictates how we act. Our identity dictates our actions. So when we love our children, and this is probably the closest that I can get to unconditional love or have at this point, and I'm praying that God helps me and I'm committing to being this way, but I just, man, it's just difficult, and I know that I am so difficult to love because I throw these condition curveballs all the time. But I look at my daughters, and it's like I see them disobey me. I see them make a mistake, and it's like, I love you, and let's walk through it. Let's do some discipline here and walk through it. But you know what? It doesn't change how I feel about you. I believe the best in you. I believe you're going to grow, and I'm going to love you to that place. Now, it's not withholding that kind of love until they get there. That's the difference, I think. The conditional love is saying, like, I will love you fully once you arrive where I want you to be. Agape love says, I'm going to love you fully right now and pray that you become that person. It's loving someone into their future. And anyone who's ever had someone look at them and speak truth into you and see something in you that you didn't see, how amazing is that in your growth and your development? If someone looks at you and says, I know what everyone else has said. I don't care what they say. I see this in you. I believe that this season in your life is coming to an end. I believe you're stronger than this. I believe you're better than that. I think you're going to stand in front of people someday. I think you are going to be an amazing wife and mother. I think that you are an incredible leader and you just never have stood up before. Someone who looks at you and speaks truth into you and sees something that no one else sees and then loves you into that. Now, are they withholding their love until you are that great leader they saw? No. No, they are loving you into that. They're bringing you. Their affection, their belief in you is actually ushering you into that future they had for you. And isn't that what we try to do for our children? We try to instill in them a belief that they can be something that they don't understand yet, that they don't see. And then we try to lead them and love them into that future, but we love them the whole time.
It's the highest and greatest form of love. Agape love does not, it's not love because you're worthy. Agape love makes you worthy. Agape love is not because you're beautiful. Agape love makes you beautiful. It's that love that pulls you into more. Because there is a rock solid love and belief that is not based on condition that ushers us into a deeper relationship that is unconditional. It's that picture of how Christ loved the church. That day, almost 14 years ago, I remember reading 1 Corinthians 13 before the service started. If you want to flip over there, I'm just going to walk through this a little bit. Think about how agape love, and this Greek word here for love is agape for sure in this passage. And as it walks through verses 4 through 13, listen how it describes the type of love that is unconditional. 1 Corinthians 13, verse 4, love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part. But when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. But when I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part. Then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. So now faith, hope, and love abide. These three, but the greatest of these is love. Did you hear it there? It always believes. It bears all things. It hopes. It endures. It's that picture that says it is an unrelenting belief. It is a commitment that bears and endures. It doesn't matter what storms come raging in from the outside. It doesn't matter what conditions change. Love that is agape, love that is unconditional, love that is the highest form of love is not deterred, it is not dissuaded, it is not distracted, it is not broken or ended. It is firmly resolved to endure and to continue and to never, ever end. It is this picture. Loves you into your future. One thing that I noticed when I was dating Angela, one of my good friends, Jerry, he was actually the best man at my wedding, and he married Angela's sister, Becca. I remember him telling me when I started to date Angela, we were describing the Holdridge girls to each other, with them not around, okay, but in a good way. And I remember Jerry saying something very profound that I saw to be immediately true. He said they know how to love well. They've got an incredible capacity to love. And that just struck me in that moment. Because it's true, isn't it? We love others. Our capacity to love others is developed, that capacity is developed by how much we've been loved, how much love we've been shown in our lives. So that's why for some who've been shown very little love, it's been a very cold upbringing, entering into relationship with another person is a big challenge as they seek to just grow their heart and let down walls and give up protection and start to risk and trust and move forward. Because they've been shown such little love, it's very hard for them to truly trust another with their heart. But Mom and Dad Holdridge that are sitting here in the back row, hi guys, good to see you, second to last row, they showed their children what it looks like to love. They modeled love for each other that was without condition. Now, their relationship was not without hiccups. It was not without disagreements. It was not perfection by some bizarre standard of perfection being defined as the absence of conflict, which that's not perfect. But there was love, and there was support, and there was belief, so that each of these children loved so fully, so completely, because they had this amazing reservoir of love that had been stored in them. So now we look at this and we say, well, how can we love someone else unconditionally if we haven't been shown that kind of love? You know, what if your parents, their love for you was very conditional? It was very approval-based. If you did well in school, you felt loved. If you did not, you did not feel loved. Or maybe for some of you that are women, your worth and your love has been dictated by how you look and your appearance. And if you're attractive enough, then you love. But if you don't feel attractive, you don't feel loved. And so you've equated love with physical looks. And so you have ride the ups and downs of that. Or men, maybe it's totally performance-based. Or maybe for you, it's your build and your fitness and your dominance of a sport or your ability to show excellence in some area. And so if you don't do well, you've been shown that your worth is tied to performance, or to looks, or to grades, or to your mind, or to something else. How do we change that? How do we fix that? I love Romans 5. Romans 5, you read this and your heart should just beat faster. Listen to what Romans 5, verses 6 through 8 says. Romans 5, 6 through 8 says, For while we were still sinners, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one would dare even to die. But God shows his love for us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. God demonstrates, God shows, God puts his love in action by dying for sinners. His actions proved his love. 1 John 4, this is a powerful passage as well. 1 John 4, 16, so we have come to know and to believe the love that God has for us. God is love, and whatever abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. By this is love perfected with us, so that we may have confidence for the day of judgment, because as he is, so also are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not been perfected in love. We love because he first loved us. That's it right there. We love because he first loved us. We are able to love with this sort of agape love because God loved us that way first. Our reservoir, our tank, what we've been shown in the area of love through Jesus Christ and his willingness to die for us, to sacrifice himself, to humble himself and become obedient to death. Because we have seen that kind of love now, because we were loved first, now we can love others that way. Because we've been shown a picture of true unconditional love, we can now love others that way. We can now love our husbands and wives that way. Why? Because we're somehow capable of it on our own? No, because we are incapable of that on our own. That's part of our sin nature, is our inherent selfishness, our inherent desire to get our own way, to do our own thing. And that's why that needs to be died to, so that one plus one can equal one. So as we die to ourselves and subtract one, then we could truly be one in Christ, because now we have this example of his love for us. And now all of us, we can't say, I can't love my wife this way, because I've never been shown love that's that great. If you're a believer in Jesus Christ, you've been shown and you've tasted and you've been saved by the greatest love the universe has ever seen and ever will see. And that is there for us to draw on. That is there for us to be encouraged by. That is there for us to be inspired by, for us to live by, for us to experience. And as we read last week, nothing can separate that from you. Nothing can take that love from you. Nothing. Human relationships, we can't always say that. We can't always say, no matter what you've done, your family will never turn your back on you. No matter what you've done, your husband or wife will always stay by you. No matter what you've done, your boss will always believe the best in you and keep you around. No matter what you've done, you'll never get cut from the team. Whatever it is, you know, in human relationships, that condition is not true. There are things that we can do, and some of you have tasted this bitter pill that you've hurt your family and they've turned their back on you because you've betrayed them, or vice versa. Or a marriage has been lost because of actions and things that have been done. Or you've lost your employment, you've been cut from the team, you've not been able to stay on this track. Why? Because in our human relationships, conditions matter. But in Christ, they don't. There's nothing you can do. There's nothing you can do to earn any more of his love. Nothing. You can't run out and say, my goodness, if I just feed more people, my goodness, if I just go and give myself to this mission, or if I start giving more, or whatever it is, nothing, that if you're trying to earn more affection from God, that is impossible, because the full measure of his love is given to you at the moment that you place your hope and trust in Jesus at the cross. There's nothing you can do to make him love you more. But the place that we live in is, there's also nothing you can do to make him love you less. Nothing you can do. I know that falls a little funny to some of you. You're like, whoa, wait. What can separate you from the love of God? What was the list? Nothing can separate you from the love of God. The unbreakable, unshakable, unconditional love of God. There's nothing you or I can do to lose that. And to think otherwise is to think that I am more powerful than God. That is somehow saying that I, of all the world, you know what? I know that's true of everyone, but I have done some things that even God cannot forgive me for. What are we saying about ourselves in that moment? Of our self-importance, of our power, of our greatness? I know that sounds weird to be like, well, isn't that humble? No, it's not humble. It's actually idolatry. It's not humility to say that you are beyond the grip of God's love because of something you've done. It is actually putting yourself in a higher position than God. Humility is saying, God, I have made another mistake, and yet I know that your love for me will never change and never end. I pray that you forgive me. Confession is good for my soul. Confession restores my distance that I've placed between you and me, not distance that you've placed between us, but distance that I've chosen to put there. I have withheld from God. I have drawn away. God does not draw away from us. In that moment, humility is not feeling unworthy. Humility is being like, I cannot believe. My goodness gracious, what love is this? That Jesus makes me worthy no matter what I've done. No matter what I've said, no matter what I've done, I'm worthy because of Jesus' love. Nothing can take that from me, not even myself and my own stupidity. There is a bedrock of love in Christ for each of us that can never be shaken or taken. When I look at the picture of love with my wife, for me, that changed everything for me. Not just in a human perspective, but spiritually. I, for the first time, understood unconditional love. I, for the first time, understood intimacy with God. I, for the first time, understood the desire for closeness. I, for the first time, understood that no matter how great our love is on this earth, God has set eternity in my heart. And that no matter how good this ever gets, you know, from the honeymoon night to great moments of amazing transcendent love and powerful commitment and just, man, excitement. It's like I could not be happier right now. No matter what that moment is, it still is a faint glimpse and whisper of what God has created for us to spend all of eternity in. Because remember, even the greatest relationships on earth will part at death, till death do us part. But there's one that never, ever ends, and that's the love that Jesus Christ has for each one of us. And so when we stand at the altar and we make a promise to each other and make vows, it is meant to not just be a human example of unconditional love. It's meant to be a spiritual reality where Jesus takes this picture and says, don't you understand The husband must love his wife as Christ loves the church and gave himself up for her. And then says the husband and wife become one flesh. It's a mystery, but it's describing the relationship that Jesus Christ has with his church. It's saying this picture of this wedding and the tears that are flowing, and we're so amazed and in awe of this great commitment of love. It is meant to be a smaller picture of a greater reality that is for each of us in Jesus. Single or married, divorced or widowed, whatever that picture is, Jesus' love for you is unbreakable and unshakable, and nothing that happens to you can take that from you. You can lose everything, and yet that will never be taken from you. When we're at weddings, we're incredibly moved. We strategically place tissue boxes. Some of you plan ahead and actually bring your own. Has anyone ever, just would admit to us today, that you have brought tissues to a wedding in anticipation of what's to come? Okay, there we go. One reluctant volunteer. Why? Why do you just know you're going to cry? Is it going to be a sad event? Hopefully not. One other part that's funny, when I first started doing weddings, I remember, you see them on TV and in the movies, and there's the whole like line that's like, if anyone feels that they have just cause, that this shouldn't happen, speak now or forever hold your peace. I remember thinking, when we were getting ready to get married, being like, oh man, what if she shows up? What if this person shows up? What if this, I'm just being so mortified of this moment that somebody might rise up and be like, there's no way I can sign off on this wedding. You know, so I asked my senior pastor of the church, I was like, so when does that fit in? He goes, hey man, that's just for the movies. We don't do that now. Don't give nut jobs a chance to ruin this thing. You know, I was like, whoa. He's like, if they haven't done something by now, they missed their chance. This is the final moment. So if you're looking forward to marriage and you're going to do it here, we won't ask that question. We'll work all that out ahead of time. You could tell me who's going to do that and we'll take care of it. So you're planning to cry. You know that your tears are going to move. Why? Not because of sadness or because you wish that that was you, hopefully, but also because it's so beautiful. It's so moving. It's a touch and a taste of eternity. And when we see true beauty like that, our hearts are just moved by it, and we feel the tears flow for some of you. It's amazing because when we see a demonstration of genuine love, I described in the beginning of the message the idea that my jaw, my mouth, when I saw Angela come down the aisle, was just agape, just blown away, just in awe, just absolutely like I've never seen anything like that. I couldn't control myself. I was there's film evidence that I was sniveling like a little schoolgirl crying up there, because it was just I couldn't even, my heart was just like I couldn't stop it, you know, like. For me, I developed the ability to like press down emotion so that I wouldn't cry, but I was just, everything was just like, it was like all those memories that make me sad enough to not cry, they all took the day off. They're like, nope, you're on your own today, buddy. As I cried, as I saw this, I just, when we're in awe of genuine love, we don't know what else to do. Our mouths fall open and our jaws drop and our eyes enlarge. It's amazing. And in Matthew 24, describes the response of the centurion to the death of Jesus. And it says that when he saw Jesus die and those that were around him, that he was filled with awe. His jaw just dropped at the genuine demonstration of love. Because when we witness agape love, awe is the natural result. When we witness genuine, unconditional love, our mouths fall agape. Kevin's going to throw up the spelling of that word up here. The word for awe. The word for being overwhelmed. Isn't it amazing that the word for awe and an uncontrollable response to something, it's pronounced agape. Kevin, can you put up the spelling for agape? There it is. Very quick slide transition. I love that. I love that, because when we're in the presence of genuine, sacrificial, and unconditional commitment of love like that, our response is just awe. Our response is to be overwhelmed and to be humbled by it. And what I'm here to tell you today, no matter what the state of your marriage is in right now, no matter what it looks like, agape love, if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, you have been shown that kind of love, an awe-inspiring, unconditional love. And you could start to look at that person and love them into their future. What would it be like? What would it be like if you just started to love your husband as if he was the man you dreamed of? Now, maybe you're already there, and that's awesome. We won't do a show of hands. It's not going to be that kind of a morning. But instead of when he does something nice for you, you start to wonder, what is he after? What has he done? What is he going to ask me to purchase? Now, I have no idea what any of that is all about. But if the dishes are done when she comes home, Ange immediately arches an eyebrow. What you up to, sweetie? Nothing. What would it be like to just believe that that's being done because of love? To not have suspicion. I'm using ourselves. I deserve that for sure, so that's why I'm good to say that. I'm not saying, and probably no one else in here has ever done anything like that to earn something. But you look at that and say, my goodness, what if that wasn't out of the norm? What if that was just, and I'm talking about purchasing vehicles or anything, you know, it doesn't just have to be where some of your minds are. But what if it was? What if it was just always believe, always hope, always persevere, always trust, and say, my goodness, this was done not because there was something to gain, not because of motivation, not because he's got to break some really bad news to me, not because all of a sudden if I go out to the garage, I'm going to see a brand new motorcycle and the dishes were going to somehow compensate for that. Whatever it may be, all of a sudden it's just like, my goodness, why? Why? It's that classic story that John Piper tells where the husband shows up at the door, knocks on it, the wife answers, and she's like, what are you doing home in the middle of the day? And he pulls out the roses, and she's like, wow, honey, my goodness, they're beautiful. I love roses. They're amazing. It's not our anniversary. It's not my birthday. Why? Why are you bringing these roses to me? And the husband looks at her and says, because it's my duty as a husband. Boop. The mood just goes, the flowers actually wilt in that moment, just right on, like, as if in a cartoon. What do you mean, your duty as a husband? That kills the romance. Instead of saying, my goodness, babe, I got you these flowers because I absolutely love you. I can't stop thinking about you. I'm so excited God gave you to me. I love you. I can't wait to spend the rest of my life with you, blah, 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 just all the things that you need to say in that moment. What if we viewed this wedding ceremony between two people? What if it was all about what you have to give up? What if the vows were, Cliff, are you prepared to no longer be able to play FIFA soccer all night long with no consequences? Maybe. No. Are you prepared to have to talk through finances with another person? Yes. Are you prepared to just be with this one person? You can't date anyone else. You can't look at anyone else. You need to make sure that you're saving yourself for them. Are you ready to give up all of your other freedoms? Are you? We don't say that because what we're committing to is something we get to have. We're receiving love. When she comes down the aisle, I am so blown away to have her as my own now. I don't focus on what I'm giving up to get her. I focus on what I'm getting from her. But yet so many of us, myself included, focus on that moment we've given our lives to Jesus Christ and we're thinking about all the stuff we've had to give up that would have been better somehow than what we're actually getting. I'm getting freedom. I'm getting a relationship with Jesus that is bigger than anything this world can understand. I'm getting purity. I'm getting holiness. I'm getting the ability to live for him. I'm getting a purpose. I'm getting a hope. I'm getting a future. And yeah, how many would say, you're a Christian? You don't get to do anything fun, man. I don't want to give up all the stuff that I like. It's not about the stuff that you've got to give up. It's about the stuff you get to take up. That makes sense when we look at a wedding and a marriage, but for some reason it's disconnected with our relationship with Jesus. Agape love It is the purest, it is the highest form of love. It is a radiant bride coming down the aisle without shame, without guilt, without blemish, totally loved, totally secure, not an ounce of fear. Don't you love that verse where it says perfect love drives out fear? That's absolutely true. Each one of us in Jesus Christ are presented to him in that way. Now, guys, before I lose you imagining yourself wearing a white wedding dress, don't go there. Think about what it means to be loved fully, even as, and to be known fully, even as you are fully known. And think about that as you come down the aisle, that Jesus Christ loves you, he knows you, he purchased you. He died for you, he rescued you. He has a plan for you and a hope for you, and he loves everything about you, and there's nothing that you can do to earn any more of his love, and there's nothing you can do to lose any of his love. You are loved completely and wholly. I love that picture of the wedding. I loved our wedding day. We've watched that wedding video so many times, it mysteriously disappeared after a while. I'm not sure where it went. But we found it. It's back, but it was out of control. But no, we watched it so many times. Why? Because it was amazing. It was beautiful. It was awesome. And every time someone came over for the first 5 years, that wedding video was somehow played. And it was a great reminder of pure, holy love. So for you this morning that are sitting here today, if you don't have a relationship with Jesus, it's an invitation to begin one. It's an invitation to give yourself to one who loves you completely and fully and unconditionally. It's one who says, 1 + 1 = 1. As we die to ourselves, we can die to who we once were, and we can become alive in Jesus. We can take up the life he has for us and be free and be whole and be forgiven and be loved.